I'm Nick Harcourt, and welcome to another episode of The Sound of Success, the podcast where we talk with movers, shakers, and just plain cool people about music.
Our guest today is Stuart Murdoch, musician, writer, and filmmaker, and the lead singer and songwriter for the band Belle and Sebastian. The group's first album, Tiger Milk, was released to critical acclaim in 1996, sparking a career that has seen them put out a series of singles, 9 EPs, and 12 albums. The most recent, Late Developers, was released in 2023, and this conversation is taking place in February of 2024. Stuart, welcome.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm speaking to you from a rainy Los Angeles. If anybody can sort of discern through this conversation that little ambient noise in the background, that's what it is. But you're in a sunny, sun-setting Glasgow this morning.
That's right. Yeah. So we've got the 4 o'clock sun here. It's got that time of year. I always think by mid-February, you start to feel a bit of brightness coming back. And we enjoy every ounce of sun we can get.
You and I have spoken before, but it's been a minute. I know you're prepping for your upcoming US tour. Let's go back a little to your early exposure to music, if we can. Your parents sent you to music lessons, and I know your first instrument became the piano. My parents sent me to violin lessons, and it didn't stick. Can you tell us about that time for you? Were you up for it, or you dragged along unwillingly?
Oh, are you talking about violin or piano?
Oh, did you have violin lessons as well?
Well, funny enough, I had violin, and that didn't stick either. In fact, funny enough, violin lessons was probably the first thing in my life that didn't stick. I was an enthusiast, and I tried everything that came along and everything my parents got me into. But my mom, they knew that they were starting free violin lessons at the school, so she put me up for that. And every week I went in with three girls who were called Linda, Linda, and Shona, and the violin teacher was just against guys. What can I say? He used to mark everybody out of 10 after every little phrase you played. And it was 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10, 7 out of 10. And I was always 4 out of 10. So I gave it up after about 3 weeks.
Well, yeah, that's weird. That are you sure it wasn't just that you weren't as good as them?
I might not have been. I mean, the thing about the fiddle is, and maybe, you know, maybe I was actually discerning that the fiddle took a bit of work to get a nice tone out of. There was a lot of scraping involved in the first little bit. And but the nice thing about the piano is you sat down and there it was. You can play a chord and you sound like Liberace straight away.
Were you in a band at school?
I was actually in a band. When I was about 11, when I went to the big school, we went, you know, the senior school, our class were called Kintyre A. And we formed a group called the Kintyre Keynotes to play at the Christmas concert. And I was playing piano and it was all instrumental. And we played mostly Beatles covers. We just settled on the Beatles for some reason. And if you look at there is a picture of the Kintyre Keynotes because, you know, there was a class picture taken. And if you look at the lineup of the Kintyre Keynotes, it's very similar to the lineup of Belle and Sebastian. it's a junior version, but this, you know, we had strings, brass, acoustic.
Mm. And just doing instrumental Beatles covers mainly.
Pretty much, yeah.
So you were a teenager in the 80s. Heading to university in Glasgow. At that time, what did you think you wanted to do with your life? What did you go to school to study?
Well, I got kind of lost at school, to be honest. The first couple of years were good fun. And then people started to leap ahead and grew up fast. And I didn't really grow up. And so I sort of lost friends. I sort of lost interest at school. They told me I was good at science. That was the only guidance I ever had was somebody said, yeah, you're good at science, do science. And so I actually went to university and I thought, you know, I'll go to university as soon as I can and maybe something will happen, you know, because I was a little bit lost.
So you just go to university because that was the thing to do?
Well, funnily enough, I was the first person in my family at that point in the 80s, you know, a lot of you know, people didn't go to university as much as they did back then. So it was quite a big deal for my family. I think my mom and dad had quite a lot of placed quite a lot of hope in me. They just, I think my mom just assumed I was always the clever one. Well, not, you know, not maybe in my family, but I was clever at school. She just thought he'll be fine. He'll go to university. They put a lot of trust in me, and I off I went up to Glasgow.
When you were in university, you became aware that you had chronic fatigue syndrome when you were at college. And I know you became quite isolated at that time. And that ultimately led to you becoming a songwriter. I read a quote from you where you said that was a big desert at the time, a kind of vacuum in my life. Can you share what that time was like for you, and then how you found expressing yourself through music helped?
Oh, absolutely. So I sort of dropped out of college, and I actually had like 3 or 4 years of being immersed in music, but not my own music, in other people's music. And I was very active. I used to DJ a lot, and I used to promote bands, and I was a roadie. And so I had a great time. And then, you know, I got sick, and I had to give all that up. And it was only when I'd given everything up that I remember being at my mum's house, because I had to go back and live with my parents again. And, you know, it was like a quiet Tuesday afternoon, and I sat at the piano, and, you know, for the first time I heard music in my head. And I felt like expressing how I was feeling, just saying some words, almost like saying some words. And then the words turned into a little tune, and that was it. It was like riding a bike, you know. Once I'd learned how to translate feeling into music, that was my project for the next, as it turned out, for the next 5 years.
So there's a great story about how the first album, Tiger Milk, came about. And I believe that you and Stuart David were enrolled in a program for unemployed musicians in Glasgow, and making demos with your professor who had been in the band The Associates, Alan Rankin. So can you pick up that story?
So that was a few years on, and finally my doctor said to me, you know, you need to, I can't keep you on the sick any longer. You seem a bit better. And they put me on a course, and that's when I met Stuart, this unemployed music course. And I sort of, to be honest with you, I didn't want them to teach me anything when I went there, because I didn't like the style of music and the taste of the most of the people that were there. But the nice thing is that they allowed you to use the recording facilities. Mm. So once every month, or once every 3 months, you got one day in the studio in which you could go in, and Stuart gave me a hand with my songs, and I would do vice versa. And so we made a tape, and somehow the tape got into the hands. Now, Alan Rankin from The Associate, he wasn't a teacher at this college, but he used to come in and use the studio in the evening with his other proteges. Somehow he managed, a tape came into his hands of the demo that I'd produced, and the class that he was teaching at another college, that was the tape that they chose to turn into a record.
And that record became Tiger Milk. And then you had to put a band together, I guess.
Well, I put the band together for the college project, which became Tiger Milk. And I had been trying to get a band together for years, found it very difficult. I couldn't get any interest. Maybe I gave off the wrong vibe. Maybe I sort of gave off a desperate sort of vibe. I'd given up trying to get a band together. And I was thinking about moving to San Francisco, because I'd been there before and people seemed to be kind of, you know, like open and welcoming to, you know, poets and songwriters. And I was just on the verge of going, but then this, you know, this college thing came out. Alan said, look, you can make a record. And it was at that point, then I started asking around. And then it was like, as it says on the sleeve notes in Tiger Milk, it was like the Magnificent Seven, because suddenly I was Yul Brynner, and I was trying to, I had the specific project in mind. And I, you know, so I asked Stevie Jackson, Stuart was already on board, and Richard was in the course. He was in the class there, and it went from there.
So when you release a record for the first time, And any expectations about how that would be received? And did you release it on cassette?
So it was a proper vinyl only LP. And, you know, I think almost like our expectations had been met just by making the thing. I think all of us, even though we were new to each other, the group had only met over the few months before. And suddenly we went into a proper music studio, which we'd never been in, which was expensive. And we were recording for 3 days. Something happened in that 3 days. And I think everybody felt it. And so it's almost like the expectation was met simply by the process of making the record. Anything else was going to be a bonus.
Well, people started talking about it, and in its limited release, you got some nice attention, and you became the first band signed to a new independent label, Jeepster Records, and you released your next album, If You're Feeling Sinister, and both Bella Sebastian and Jeepster Records really were off and running off of that record. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. We were running. I was running. I think, I mean, I was the, you know, the engine that was obviously feeding the machine. But because I'd been waiting for so long, I had stacks of songs, and I was writing a lot of songs, you know, for the band. So I just wanted to keep recording. And, you know, Jeepster were telling me to slow down, and they wanted to wait for another 6 months to put out the record. They wanted to, and I said, just put it out. Put it, you know, like, I want the two records. I want Sinister out before the end of the year. It's a real statement of intent. And I want to move on. I want to do a bunch of singles after this. So, they were a little bit reticent. I was just like, do it, do it, do it, you know. And I, you know, that kind of thing when you know what you don't know, or vice versa. I was just feeling it. I had to fight a lot of decisions in the early days. But I think and the irony is that sort of 5 years into the band, the same people were kind of turned around and said, why don't you do what you did in the old days? So you've always got to, you know, I think a good thing about being in the band, and it's not always just about me. If you listen to what other people are saying, usually somebody has the strongest feeling, and usually that strongest feeling is the right feeling. So it's, it's good to be in a band for that reason.
As you said, you released a bunch of singles as well. Next album was The Boy with the Arab Strap, and the band's growing in popularity, but you're keeping a low profile, really, not doing a ton of PR or interviews or photos. And you're living in a church, which is a place that you live for a long time and used to record as well.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, we around about the time of Arab Strap, actually the EPs just before that and into Arab Strap, we started recording in the church itself, which was I lived in the upstairs little flat, and downstairs there was a large hall, and we brought all the gear in there during the summer when the hall was quiet, and we parked a mobile studio outside, and we just wanted to, we were actually a little bit disappointed in the sound of If You're Feeling Sinister. You know, we felt that, you know, I think it was quite a naive production. We were quite rushed, and we felt that if we could be in a church hall where we could see each other while we were playing, and we could capture the ambience of the hall, that it would help the record.
So by the time you work your way through into the 2000s, the band's popularity and recognition is growing. I think that's the first time I met you, although I do remember in my first radio gig in Woodstock, playing like Dylan in the movies. And then I moved to Los Angeles around about the time, really, as you guys were ramping up. My career in LA was also ramping up, and you found your music making its way into movies like High Fidelity and Juno and television shows. What kind of impact did that exposure have on the work? Of course, we're talking about the United States really now.
Do you know, it's funny. I was thinking about that today because somebody said they heard one of our songs on a TV show last night. And in the beginning, for years, we didn't do it. We wouldn't let our music be used in movies. And, you know, it was that kind of old school. We thought it was sort of selling out, and,
yeah,
you know, didn't want the song to be matched with the scene, and that would be in everybody's head. And it's funny how quickly that goes out the window when you say yes for the first time. And And then you think, well, that wasn't so bad. And even when they were slagging off, even when Jack Black was slagging off our record in High Fidelity,
yeah,
it was kind of funny. And I'm glad that we were on that in that movie. It's such a funny movie. And so, yeah, I guess that did. I mean, we already had, you know, in the start of 2000s, when we came to the States for the first time consistently, we did have a lot of people that wanted to see us. But I think it helped that the music was in these other mediums. It always adds up to something. And then so it helped keep the party going.
So the last time I saw you perform, and I'm going to rectify this in a couple of months when you come back to LA, but it was Belle and Sebastian at the Hollywood Bowl with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Just how big a deal was that for you and the band?
You know, around about that time, I felt there was, at the start of the year looking forward, there was always one thing in the calendar that would stand out, you know. And in the early days, we had this gig at the Albert Hall in London, which was by far the biggest gig we'd played. And I was thinking, whoa. And you walk in the place and you're like, whoa. And then a couple of years later, it was the Hollywood Bowl, you know, by far the biggest headline show we had played. And it kind of was everything that you thought it could be and more. It's a beautiful sunlit memory. I particularly remember I was a little bit late for sound check. I used to make my own way to sound check, and my, you know, tour manager was pissed off at me. But I stepped onto the stage just in time. The first time on the stage, the band was there, the orchestra was in front of me, the conductor was waiting with his baton. And then I'm looking out at all the seats going right up into the hill. And I was like, wow, okay, this was amazing. So even the sound check was amazing.
Playing live has always been a big part of what you've done, but you've also had to pace yourselves as well. And I know that with your illness, sometimes you can't perform. But through the years, you've done so many shows and festivals, including your own festivals, the Bowley festivals that you curated. First one was at a Pontins holiday camp in 1999. And I think I should ask you to explain for people who are not in the UK what a Pontins holiday camp is.
Yeah, it's very British. Mind you, saying that, I think you do have... you do have sort of holiday camps or something like it, maybe in the Catskills, or the idea of, like, you know, like Dirty Dancing or something like that.
Yeah.
But this was a very British version of the holiday camp. I worked at one called Butlins for 3 years in the 80s. And it was a little bit like maybe what you would imagine a large military base to be like, with the little huts for people to stay in, and then they had large venues for dancing and drinking and all the funny British summer activities that you got.
Right. So putting a festival in a holiday camp was a little different for sure.
It was. I mean, if I hadn't worked at Butlins, it wouldn't have occurred to me. But I was never a fan of music festivals, especially because I had ME and things were just, I'd never went to one, and because things were difficult for me. So I thought, let's get a little comfort in here. Let's set a tent. Let's give people these little huts, these little chalets, and also they can come and they can mix. It'll be a nice hang for the whole weekend.
And I know it was a big success, but you didn't repeat it for 20 years. And when you did, in 2019, you took pals like Mogwai and Teenage Fan Club with you on a cruise around the Med. And now I know you decided not to do cruises anymore because of the environmental impact of that stuff. But that must have been a lot of fun to have a bunch of serious fans on a boat in the Med.
That was amazing. I mean, that was right up there with the Hollywood Bowl, actually, just the experience. We'd actually tried to do the boat thing before the first Bowley Festival. It was meant to be a boat thing, a UK tour on a ship, you know, back in 1998, because my dad was a sailor and he was advising me, and, you know, it sort of fell through. And then, you know, the idea went away. And then I think you know, it became a thing where bands did go to the Caribbean and stuff like that. So when the company was coming to Europe, I was so glad that they asked us first because they knew that we'd been trying to do this before. And I mean, it was a beautiful, even just the geography of it, everybody meeting up in Barcelona and sailing to Sardinia.
Sounds awful.
Yeah, it sounds terrible.
Genre-specific cruises have become quite a thing over the last few years. Will there be another version of a Boli?
Well, we thought we'd bring it back home. We're actually doing we're doing what we call the Glasgow Weekender, which is sort of Boli Light in Glasgow in August. And we say Boli Light. I wanted to sort of have accommodation as well so that everybody would be in the same place. But in the city, it's harder to organize that kind of thing. So it's just going to be a city festival, but it will be on a really nice site beside the Clyde, and there's a garden, and our friends Camera Obscura are one of the bands that are playing so far.
As I mentioned in the intro, you're now up to 12 albums, and the last two, a bit of previous and late developers, came back to back in 2022 and 23. I'm guessing the pandemic shutdown led to a burst of creativity.
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't sure that I wanted to do another record, and our label Matador asked us, said, come on, give us a proper LP. And it was fun for me. We had a lot of songs. That was, as you say, during the lockdown, and with that extra time, we came up with a lot more songs. And I said to the group early on, let's do two LPs. You know, let's actually aim for that. Let's make it fun for us, or fun for me. And it was good fun.
And you had to set up the studio in a way where you were all isolated as well, correct?
Well, that was pretty early on, yeah. Within sort of 5 months of the lockdown starting, when we came back, we had to be very careful. But I know a lot of people had really tough time during lockdown, and I don't mean to sound so glib, but it was actually quite a happy and productive time. Though I don't think, in my mind, there was no better way to spend that time except, you know, going into the studio every day, and then coming out into the deserted streets and listening over to the music that you produced.
You have young children as well. I mean, how are you dividing what I'm presuming was a lot of time at home with the studio time? Is it like living two separate lives?
Yeah, it was. Well, my wife made a deal with my wife that favored me. she was great about it. I mean, she knew that we were going to make a record. We were meant to make a record anyway. So I would have been away a lot of the time. So I was at home, and she said, look, just do what you're going to do. Go to the studio. But we had an au pair. We had a nanny who was sort of like, we kind of grabbed her at the last minute. She was going back to London, and we said to her, no, you're going to be stuck in this, you know, come just live with us during the lockdown. So it was great. It was great for everybody. We actually had a pretty nice, relaxed 6 months. My oldest kid's kind of on the autistic spectrum and was having a difficult time at school. And so he was delighted. He was in really good form, you know, because he didn't want to go to school anyway.
Let's jump to our music questions, the same ones that I ask everybody. What is your first musical memory?
Okay, I'm kind of going to say the first thing that comes to mind, even though I might think of it something. I was in an organization called the Imps, which were a very junior boys kind of churchy organization, and they had a little Christmas show, and I remember we sang Bare Necessity from the
Jungle Book.
Think of the Bare Necessities. I'm not sure. I think we might have done King of the Swingers as well. I think we might have done both numbers. because it's such a great, you know, Jungle Book's fantastic for music. So that was certainly my first performance, you know, maybe when I was 4 or 5.
Love it. What about buying music? What was the first music you bought with your own money?
Well, I remember buying stuff at the jumble sale and picking up, you know, some punk singles, but also Bridge Over Troubled Water LP. The first one that I actually bought, like full, you know, full price, went into a shop and bought was Hotter Than July, Stevie Wonder, which was $79.80 and on cassette, and it had the great single Master Blaster jamming it.
What was the first concert you went to without parents or adult supervision?
Yeah, well, this was quite a swing from Stevie. I wish I could claim it was Stevie Wonder or something, but a couple of years after, you know, I started buying music, I was into metal, and there was a movement called the New Wave of British Heavy Metal. One of the bands was a band called Budgie, who might have been from Wales. Budgie came to Air Pavilion, which was the little concert place in the town that I lived in. So Budgie were my first band.
Do you remember how it made you feel being in a room full of other people listening to live music?
I think you remember the visceral things, and it was just the volume. I could not believe that. I didn't know if I was going to be able to stand it. The volume was just like making your whole body shake and your ears screech. And I was like, no, I got to do it. I can't leave. I can't, you know, I don't want to be a wimp.
You walk out with your ears ringing for the rest of the night.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you listen to when you want to dance?
That's a good question. So many tunes. You know, this is a little bit disappointing. The last time I went out to a place where I was dancing, my knees are in bad shape from so many years of running and playing football that it hurt. It hurt to dance.
Oh, no.
But I think it was one of my favorite DJs, a guy called Andy Symington, who ran a club called Divine. And he was actually playing at this night. But and I've been going to his clubs like way back since the 80s. And he plays this really nice mix of Northern soul and funk, you know, the old 60s and 70s stuff. So that's, I would say, yeah, I mean, I could tell you some tunes, but it's that sort of flavor, I think.
What do you listen to when you're feeling sad?
Well, I mean, I've actually, not to give too much detail, but I've had quite, in the last year, you know, it's off, you know, I've had quite a depression. And when I feel like I can't listen to music, you know, I can't listen to music and I can't watch anything. And the best thing I can do is to try and sort of meditate. And it's only when I'm feeling a little bit better that I can come back to the music. And then it would be something maybe like Cocteau Twins or Felt or the Sundays. Something soft and reliable.
Are you somebody who listens to music to take you out of the depression, or somebody who listens to music to sort of ride with you?
Yeah, I found that it's tricky getting out of the depression, and so yeah, I've got to be back up at a certain level to enjoy the music again, and then it's a relief. You know, but thankfully, you know, this year specifically, I've been getting better, feeling better, and then I'll put on live music. I'll get on my put in my headphones first thing in the morning. I go around in a little scooter, you know, it saves my knees, and I I belt around Glasgow in the scooter listening to Age of Consent by New Order. That's a great Monday mornings.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you could only hear one song for the rest of your life, what would you pick?
I'd maybe say, I mentioned the Sundays, and they've got a song called Can't Be Sure, which was their first single. And I think I'd probably pick that one. If I only had that one song, then at least I could listen to it maybe like, you know, once in the morning, once in the evening. I've never tired of it. I listen to it. I probably listen to it every day. So Can't Be Sure by the Sundays.
Do you have a favorite music video?
Well, the classic one that always springs to mind is that is that I just mentioned New Order, but they had a song called True Faith.
Mm-hmm.
And when that music video came out, everybody was like, whoa, is this really arty, strange things with mannequins, except they were moving and dancing. It was very rhythmic. I can't remember the director, but, you know, that was back in the day when, you know, like you talk about 1986, when if you managed to see a video, it was kind of a miracle. You know, you had to tune into the television at a certain time of the week once,
yeah,
in the hope that the video would be on. And so that felt really special. So I'd say that one, True Faith by New Order.
I was reading something the other day talking about you making new videos. And this kind of ties into a question that I didn't get to earlier on. So just sort of take a sidebar on these music questions for a second. But I know that you've got a younger audience who are discovering Belle and Sebastian, and that you put out a request to people to come up with video ideas. And you've been working with some younger people on making new Belle and Sebastian videos. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
The funny thing is when you make an LP, videos are always the last thing you think about. And then when you make two LPs, suddenly there's a lot of videos and then there's never any money. And so we had to get a little bit inventive this time. But I was just thinking, you know, we had this track called Talk to Me, Talk to Me, and which Sarah and I co-wrote. And I said to her, why don't we see if anybody wants to do a video for this? You've got to be careful. You can't just be exploitative, you know, like ask people to make the video and then show it. You know, we were sort of like seriously looking for ideas, the best ideas. And these, I think it was two sisters from London that came up with the best idea, and also the way that they pitched it. They had this sort of energy. They had a good vibe about them. And they were, you know, I mean, one of them was still at school. And yeah, we just let them get on with it. And it was a super fun video. It was something we would never have come up with, which I think is quite exhilarating, that you feel that, you know, other people have authorship or ownership over their ideas and their music, and they could do something that you could never do.
Do you have a recent musical discovery that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I'm pretty hopeless. I do like there's a group, well, it's a singer whose name is Kira, but she's known as CMAT, C-M-A-T. My friend just, you know, said, you got to check this out. And, you know, he played me a recording of her actually on British TV. And I thought, wow, you know, and so we chased after CMAT to come and play at the Glasgow Weekender, which she is. So that's amazing. There was another band that I was super keen on called Say She She.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know those guys.
Yeah, they're doing well.
Yeah. They had a single, I don't know whether it was a year ago or maybe a year and a half ago. And straight away I was like, wow, this is great. What a sound. And we tried to get them for our festival, but those guys couldn't make it. Mind you, if they're listening and somehow, you know, they suddenly realize there's a little gap in their schedule and they might be in Glasgow, you're still welcome to come by.
What band or artist do you love, but you feel that they perhaps never quite got the big break they deserved? I have a feeling you might have a few folks that fit into that category.
Yeah, well, there's almost ones like the Go-Betweens, the Australian group, the Go-Betweens, that it's so recognized that they didn't quite get where they were meant to be or where they were heading.
Yep.
That it's almost been well documented. Whereas a group like Felt that were even, you know, it's probably my number one group. I accept that's probably where they got to is probably where they were meant to be, and that they were meant to be special to a certain amount of people, and maybe not so much. Whereas the Go-Betweens had a thing that it's a shame in a sense if they'd had like a big hit, maybe about four or five LPs in, it might have been a stepstone to becoming not REM, but, you know, something a little bit bigger, you know, somewhere halfway between REM, Crowded House or something. You know, that's the story of music. That's the story of pop music.
Yeah, exactly. I lived in Brisbane in Australia right about the time that they were sort of ending, but did get to see them in the early 80s. And two of my favorite songwriters, Robert Forster and Grant McLennan, for sure, done some great solo stuff as well. But you're right, if they just had the one song. But eventually that's sort of what it comes down to, isn't it? That's the story of success in music, having the right song at the right time that hits enough people.
It's a funny old business. I do feel sometimes, even I get a little bit frustrated because the underground's fine and going along is fine. But sometimes you feel if you get this one shot where you get a proper, song that goes viral, goes out there, then you almost come back. You have permission. You have to flex your muscles. And but I'm not complaining.
I always say that having a hit buys you a little freedom.
I would think so. I would think so. We give you a real shot in the arm.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, look what we can do. And because you end up playing those games anyway, you try to sort of imagine that you've made hits, and then it's not quite the same.
Do you have a musical guilty pleasure?
Not really, because I think all that kind of middle of the road schlock that I've always insisted that I love has become more sort of mainstreamy, or, I've never been shy of, right off the bat when people were asking what were Belle and Sebastian's influences, and I'd be talking about certain hits from the 70s, and they were saying, really? What about the Velvet Underground or the Love and Spoonful? And so, I think they're all out there. They're all on paper. They're all on the internet somewhere.
Right. And we always wrap up with this final question, and that is, how are you feeling right now?
Right now, background optimistic, foreground pretty relaxed. I've got a lot on my plate, but you need to stay in the moment, people. That's the key to not being overwhelmed, is to stay in the moment. Don't drag your past with you, and don't get too worried about the future. So I live hour to hour, so I'm pretty relaxed.
Well, you have a nice smile on your face as we're wrapping this up, so I believe you. That's a great it's great advice. Yeah, stay in the moment if you can, because can't fix the past and the future's actually not here yet. So it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Likewise, Nick. Great to see you.
Appreciate it.
It's nice to catch up with old friends,
I'll see you soon.
Cheers, Nick. All the best.
The Sound of Success is hosted and produced by me, Nick Harcourt, for Nude and Ginger Productions. Our theme music is by Keita Klein. For more episodes, find us on Apple and Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends, and thanks for listening.